You're listening to the Watched It in the 80s podcast. Hi, everyone. I'm Damien.
And I'm Jerry.
And welcome back to Watched It in the 80s, a podcast where we talk about movies and TV from that great decade known as the 80s. It's been a little while since I put a podcast out. Sorry about that. Sometimes things come up and I just can't get podcasts out as much as I'd like. But we're back now for Halloween and our first spooky slash horror slash thriller movie of the month is Poltergeist from 1982, which starred Jo Beth Williams and Craig T. Nelson. Poltergeist is a Steven Spielberg production. He wrote the screenplay along with Michael Grais, I believe it's pronounced Grais, and Mark Victor, and it was directed by Toby Hooper. As you heard, I have Jerry with me today, or maybe, shall I say, he's here. Gotta do it like that. How you doing, Jerry? It's been a while since you've been on the podcast. We did Outland a few months ago. What you been up to? How's everything going?
Oh, it's going really good. I was on Adrenaline Cinema a couple times in the interim. We did Escape from the Planet of the Apes and Omega Man.
Okay. Omega Man I've heard of. Mm-hmm. I've never seen. Did they ever redo that?
Yeah, it was the one I Am Legend with Will Smith.
Oh, okay. Wow, that's interesting. Okay. I like I Am Legend, so.
Yeah, but the Omega Man was actually a remake of a movie called The Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I'll have to check that out because I like I Am Legend, so I imagine I'd like Omega Man. It's mm-hmm. When's it from? The 60s?
74.
74? Okay, cool.
Is that another Charlton Heston film?
Ah, there you go. Awesome. All right. So let's get right into our plot summary here. Did you want to go ahead and take care of that?
Yes. Strange and creepy happenings beset an average California family, the Freelings, Steve, Diane, teenage Dana, 8-year-old Robbie, and 5-year-old Carol Ann, when the ghosts commune with them and through the television set. Initially friendly and playful, the spirits turn unexpectedly menacing. And when Carol Ann goes missing, Steve and Diane turn to a parapsychologist and eventually an exorcist for help.
Yeah, as we'll get into a little later, especially when we get into the whole parapsychologist and our exorcist slash medium, that's something you drive over sometimes on the road. We find out there's poltergeists and there's hauntings. And, you know, it seems like the poltergeists here are pretty harmless in the beginning. But then we come to find out that there's actually something very evil at play. So looking forward to getting into it here. Let's jump into our cast notes. I'll start off, like I mentioned before, it was Poltergeist was directed by Toby Hooper. He started with shorts and some documentary shorts in 1959 through the 60s and 70. I'm sorry, through the 60s. His first film was Eggshells in 69. And his second was the critically acclaimed The Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 74. Others included Eaten Alive, The Funhouse, and the TV miniseries Salem's Lot, Parts 1 and 2, a personal favorite of mine. I get a kick out of Salem's Lot. Haven't seen it in a long time, but I first time I saw it, I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen that, too. But it also... it also needs mentioning that this year is the 40th anniversary of Poltergeist.
Oh, yeah. Why? Yeah, that's why we talked about doing this. And shame on me for not mentioning that, mentioning it right away. Yeah, it was released June 4th, 1982. So, yep, we're 40 years into it here. So you want to go ahead with our next cast member?
Yes, we have Jo Beth Williams, who plays Diane. On TV before Poltergeist, she was in a show called Jabberwocky, Somerset, The White Shadow, and several episodes of The Guiding Light. And movies before then include Kramer versus Kramer, Stir Crazy, and The Dogs of War.
Okay. Next, we have Craig T. Nelson, who plays Steven. Let's see. He was credited for The Return of Count Yorga, Stir Crazy as well. Well, that's interesting. They were both in Stir Crazy. Private Benjamin, TV. He was credited with Mary Tyler Moore, Charlie's Angels, Wonder Woman, The White Shadow, WKRP in Cincinnati, as probably as well as some others. So an established actor getting into this movie here.
Yeah, next we have Heather O'Rourke, who plays Carol Ann, and she only had an episode of Fantasy Island prior to Poltergeist because being five does not lend itself to a big filmography.
I know, so young, but so good in this. Yeah, the Fantasy Island, wow, that'd be neat to see her in whatever episode that is. Probably be able to look it up on YouTube. Oliver Robbins, another young actor here, played Lil Robbie. Looks like his career started in 1982, along with Poltergeist. He was also in a few TV movies, Don't Go to Sleep and Million Dollar Infield. He was also in Airplane 2, the sequel, which also came out at some point in 1982.
Next, we have Zelda Rubinstein, who plays Tangina Behrens, my personal favorite character in this film. Yes, she's great.
Steals the show.
Yeah, exactly. She was in Under the Rainbow with Harrison Ford. I remember watching that one. The Flintstone Comedy Show and a movie called Americathon.
Yeah, and she has such a unique speaking voice. I imagine she probably did quite a bit of cartoons and animations before that as well. And probably after a little bit until her death. Yeah. But yeah, a very unique voice, and she's a great character. Get a kick out of her a bunch. We'll talk about her. Now we have Dominique Dunn, who played the oldest daughter, Dana, started appearing on TV in 1979, and, started appearing on television in 1979. Some of the TV episodes she was in were on shows such as Lou Grant, Breaking Away, Heart to Heart, and Fame.
Okay, next we have James Caan, who plays Mr. Teague. He is a very experienced TV and film actor. Some of his over 200 credits include recurring characters on All My Children, Eight Is Enough, and other single appearances and guest spots on shows like The Love Boat and Starsky and Hutch.
Yeah, he was in one-offs on many, many TV shows up until this point. Yeah, so he was a good go-to actor.
A very good character actor.
Mm-hmm. And also, without going into much detail, some other key characters in the Poltergeist were the parapsychologist team. Of course, we had Dr. Lesh, played by Beatrice Straight, Ryan, played by Richard Lawson, and of course, Marty, played by Martin Casella. Okay, let's move on to awards here. What do we have? We have Poltergeist was nominated for 3 Academy Awards for Best Effects/Visual Effects. And that was courtesy of the team of Richard Edlund with Michael Wood and Bruce Nicholson. Also, Best Effects/Sound Effects Editing, Stephen Hunter Flick and Richard L. Anderson were responsible for that. And, of course, Best Music/Original Score by Mr. Jerry Goldsmith.
Oh, a master. The master.
Yeah, right.
I should say.
Absolutely. Richard Edlund did win a BAFTA award for Best Visual Effects. And finally, Poltergeist was, of course, recognized by the Saturn Awards by winning Best Horror Film, Best Supporting Actress, Zelda Rubinstein, and Best Makeup as well. Oh, and was also nominated for, a Saturn Award was also nominated for Best Actress, Jo Beth Williams, Best Director, of course, Toby Hooper, Best Music as well. Okay, let's head on now to our overall thoughts. Why don't you go ahead first?
I freaking love this movie. When I saw it when I was 11, damn, from the first time I love it. You know, first time, I loved it, you know. And for its time, these effects were top-notch. Acting and writing are really damn good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as far as me, terrified me, you know, when I was younger. There are some scenes, you know, which we'll get into that kind of stick with you. And I didn't like it, but you know, if it was on TV, I'd watch it until like the really scary stuff happened. But revisiting it now after all these years, it's awesome. It does not, you know, we talked before the special effects doesn't hold up. Might be a little slow by today's standards. Of course, there was a remake, I think, in 2015, was it? I think.
Correct.
Which I did not see. So it's, by today's standards, obviously it's not a great movie, but as far as early 80s, it was fantastic, I think. A great Steven Spielberg film. I really enjoyed it. I love revisiting it. I even got one of my kids to watch it. He was into it too, so that's pretty good that we can always keep sharing the history of film with the next generation
Exactly.
as the 80s become, like the 40s were for us. So moving on, let's go just jump right into our favorite and notable scenes here. I think we said you would go ahead and start off.
Yes. But I almost want to say just like damn near every scene is memorable. So, but I love the opening with the Star Spangled Banner playing over the TV, ending the broadcast day, and a lot of our younger listeners will not know what that means because TV used to end, midnight, 12, like sometimes 1 o'clock in the morning. Finish off with the Star Spangled Banner to say, and so concludes our broadcast day, and then turn to static.
Yeah, and there was nothing after until whatever the morning news or whatever the first early show was, but that was yeah, that's a pretty good throwback to back in the days. And it's good, yeah, the Star Spangled Banner. Great way to start the movie off, I think. Was there something else that you wanted to add to that, or that was like just that's what you wanted to kick us off with?
Yeah, that was it because it's just people, a lot of people do not know that TV used to end for the day.
Yeah, and it's hard, and they probably won't ever grasp it. But yeah, the old well, we only got what, two, three channels back then. So
I think I had four.
the four, there you go. All right. Well, the first one I want to talk about is a little further into the movie after the incidents start happening with the poltergeists, and that's Diane showing Steve the sliding across the floor trick. She's been home all day. Things started getting a little bit strange in the morning. I think the mat, chaos at the breakfast table, obviously with three kids, and the glass of milk broke. Okay, that could happen anytime. Glasses break, whatever. I think the kid recognized that, saw that some of his silverware, the spoon and fork, were bent. Although I don't think he ever pointed it out to his mom, but I'm sure if she did the dishes, she noticed that. But of course, the chairs started moving. And that's what got mom a little freaked out, and then they stacked on the table. So she's been dealing with this all day, and Stephen comes home from work, and I just love how, he comes home, the garbage cans are like still there, and he's just typical, oh, I come home from work, gotta deal with the garbage cans. She comes running out of the house, grabs him like, you gotta see this before it goes away, come on, and drags him in there, and he has no idea what the heck she's talking about, and she's been dealing with this all day, so she's like super excited, and how she deals with it is funny. It doesn't freak her out in a way. She thinks it's like, it's pretty cool, pretty whatever, just something amazing. So she shows him first the chair moves, and then it's so funny when she puts a little Carol Ann on the floor with her football helmet on
Yes.
and slides across the floor, and she's like, Mommy, that burns. And the look on Craig T. Nelson's face is he's just like, what the heck am I seeing? He's kind of reacting totally different, like the rest of us would, like, this is totally bizarre. There's no explanation for this. What am I seeing? And the mom's just so, she's already beyond that point. She was at that point early in the morning. Now she's at the point of, this is exciting. What else can we do? What else can we move? But
She's
I
just
just,
like, yeah, she's
yeah.
just like exhilarated from
Exactly.
all the fun she's having with it.
Yeah, it's just, but I just love that. Craig T. Nelson just kind of plays it perfectly. Like, I'm just totally stunned and have no words for what is just happening. He can't explain it. He's looking at the bottom of the chairs and stuff like that. And then, of course, they go to the neighbors and stuff like that to find out if anything else is happening. But no, I get a kick out of that just from the two different actors, the two actors and their different styles of the way they're playing the scene. They're not both freaked out at the same time. It's like one's super, like you said, exhilarated and like, oh, check this out. But yeah, that's kind of all I have to say about that one. Do you want to move on?
Yes, my next one is when Carol Ann is watching the ghost come out of the TV and shoot up into the wall.
Okay, so this is like the night before. This is the night before the chair incident. Okay.
Yeah, but what I liked about that is that you see the effect of, like, it looks like a hand kind of popping out, and it kind of startles her. And then when it's all the whatever entities are flying out of the TV, and you can see her hair just like fly up like it got blasted, hair blast. And these are these nice compositing effects that I really like, that you can make something there look like it's there when it's not actually there, and
Oh,
just
definitely.
add it in like with the animation later. But
Right.
it was pretty damn great for its day.
And I noticed, and I had to check this out a little bit. This reminded me a lot of the effects from Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark when, at the end when the spirits came out of the ark. It just looked almost like that. And I did look, and Robert, is it Robert Edlund, right? I think his first name's Robert. It is Edlund, right? The special effects. He was a supervisor, special effects supervisor on Indiana Jones. So, which was also Steven Spielberg. So you do see a lot of that influence there, I think, as far as the special effects, the same style. They were only a year apart, so there probably really wasn't that much technology available to them. Whatever they had, they used. And it was, I'm with you. It was actually pretty cool. And there's some other instances later, which we'll talk about, where you actually see other different kinds of spirits and ghosts and things like that. But no, that's pretty cool, and that's the first time we actually get to see that there are in fact ghosts, because up until this point it was just a little girl talking to the TV, and maybe some sounds. I think you can hear some other different sounds in the television. Don't know if you could actually make out voices or words, but it did sound like there was something beyond the static. Yeah, so very cool.
And then
Oh,
they had
sorry.
the And it, after it all finished up, it shook the house, and I thought they were having an earthquake, and nobody else seemed to
Yeah, right.
that.
Yeah, yeah, that's another thing about this movie that kind of trips you out, is like, how much is it are these people going to deal with before they just like get the hell out? Because yeah, you have an earthquake that nobody else happens and no happens to notice. And then of course the my next scene, which is also something that's kind of tied into that, is the tree attack slash Carol Ann being sucked into the light. So this is, I guess it's the next night. There's another storm, and from the night before, Stephen, father, told his son what to do when there's a storm. Count between the thunder and lightning. That way, however many seconds you have, that's whether it's going away or whether it's coming closer. So this night, it seems like the storm is obviously coming closer and everything. And then finally, the tree, which has kind of been freaking the boy out a little bit. If he's been, I'm gonna say freaking it out. He was fascinated because he was climbing it earlier in the movie, to kind of check out just its different features, I guess. And he kind of saw a face in it, and he was just taking a close look at it during the daylight when it was safe, right? And then of course the night that you were talking about, I think. That first night, the shadows kind of freaked him out a little bit, but his dad calmed him down, told him how the tree was there to protect him. But this night was a little different. The tree was really freaking him out, and the storm was freaking him out. And then finally, the tree busts in, actually grabs him.
Like two big branches come in, like.
Yes. And then like pulls him in. Now I remember seeing this when I was younger, and this was one of those scenes I was talking about that was a little bit traumatizing, because the tree like sucks the boy in there, and you're like, oh my gosh, what's happening? The family's freaking out trying to get him, and then the dad does get him out, and then the tree gets sucked away in a tornado, and they just chalk it up, like you said, we're the only people that had an earthquake. Well, they were the only people that had a tornado the next night. And they're like, oh, it's perfectly fine, a tornado, nothing to worry about. Sucked the little boy in the tree, and but they did get him out, and he was just covered in, like, I want to say that was sap. I think when I was younger I thought it was blood, but I'm pretty sure it was just tree sap that was on him.
It was like sap and mud and
yeah
among other things, but yeah,
yeah
but it was used as the distraction to get Carol Ann.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, right. Because at that point, like I said, that was the other part of this, was that then in the little kid's room, the closet door, the light in the closet, the closet opens up and the light sucks pretty much the entire room in the closet, including Carol Ann, minus the mattresses that don't fit. But no, that was just such a dramatic scene in the first real scene we get that's like, okay, that is, like I mentioned before, up until this point, it's almost been like friendly nuisance poltergeists up to this point. And then at that point, you have the actual demon or evil spirit, whatever you want to call it.
I think they called it the Beast.
The Beast, which you can interpret it different ways, you know, but yeah, she does refer to it as the Beast. So there is like a menacing evil figure in this other world, the other dimension where Carol Ann is, where the other ghosts and poltergeists are that are trapped or in limbo, if you will. So, yeah, but definitely I like that part very much, and it scared me as a kid, but right now it was quite enjoyable to revisit that. And it blows my mind how they can just chalk it up to, okay, yeah, it was just a tornado that hit our house, but whatever. I think after that point, since Carol Ann was gone and they found out she was in television, then, you know, that kind of like shifted things and we're not worried about the tree and the tornado anymore. One part I did want to say about that was, I love the shot, speaking of Carol Ann in the TV, when they first notice that she is in the television. And the mom's sitting there trying to console Robbie. And when the mom hears the voice of Carol Ann, she just kind of like stretches her hand out, which is like all covered in mud and dirt because they were out in that swimming pool trying to find Carol Ann, and just kind of reaches her hand out and just slowly touches the TV. And then you hear like the little static you get if you touch the TV screen back in the day, you know, when her fingers touch it, which is pretty cool. But I just love that shot. That's like, that's just such a fantastic shot that they did there.
Yeah, I agree.
Anything else you wanted to add to that?
No, that was it. So.
Okay, cool. You're up next with your next point.
Okay, when they bring in Dr. Lesh and her cohorts, you know, with, was it Ryan and Marty?
Mm-hmm.
They open up the bedroom door and they're thinking they're just going to see, you know, because before that they're talking about a toy car moving slowly across the linoleum. But here they see the bed spinning around, clown laughing, Hulk riding a horse, Rick LP spinning in air played by a compass needle,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. Yeah, they were thinking it was just, you know, going to be something simple, but nope, this is going to be a hell of a lot harder than you think.
Yeah, they had never seen anything like this before, and you could get that, even though I don't think they ever uttered those words. Maybe one of the guys did when they were talking amongst themselves about, we've never recorded anything like this before, but you could just tell, because when they were interviewing Steven, which this kind of ties into my next point too, bringing in the parapsychologist, when they were interviewing Steven, their job is to be skeptics, but still professional. Mm-hmm. And staying with what they believe, you know, so, which some people, not saying whether it's right or wrong or something, some people may not obviously believe in the supernatural, but anyway, there are groups of people out there that do, and they're the parapsychologists, and this is what they do, so they're going to be professional in that aspect. They're still they have to be skeptics, because obviously there are hoaxes out there. There are people who might be other influences. You know, they ask Stephen all these personal questions. There's probably other personal questions that they ask that weren't even on camera, just to make sure, okay, is this guy legit? Is this something else going on here? But mm-hmm. yeah, to your point, when he mentioned the matchbox car, 7 hours for it to move, I forget the distance.
Yeah.
And Stephen just kind of looks at him like, huh. Okay, like that's your claim to fame. That's what you're proud of. Wait till you open this door, but
he gave them the whole
But no, I'm with you. That was pretty cool with the spinning around. I mean, obviously, again with the effects, it looks really cheesy now, but still the the compass, the most dangerous school, most dangerous school. What word am I looking for? Anyway, school supply. The most dangerous school supply that you could provide a child back in the day is the compass. But that would always poke out of my book bag. I don't know about you, but by the end of the school year, there'd be a hole in my book bag from the compass. But yeah, that almost came flying at the doctor, and like you said, the record playing. And that damn clown, which we'll get into again, he was just there laughing.
Well,
Yeah, but another point I wanted to make about the parapsychologist is anytime there's any kind of these haunting, or possession movies or something like that, I always appreciate that first step when they bring in the parapsychologist. Because typically, which we didn't see in this, there's normally the regular authorities or whatever, other family, friends, maybe clergy or something like that, that are in the state of denial. They're like, no, this isn't, what are you talking about? You people are crazy and everything like that. But I always appreciate when they bring in the parapsychologist because that's normally the first little point or first little instance that you can see that the family or whoever is in their person or whatever is gonna get some help. Because you feel for this fa in some cases you feel for the family. In this case, they're missing their daughter, but in most of these movies, they're heavily traumatized. There's some sort of violence. Their life is in utter hell. And anytime you bring in like a parapsychology or that one person or a medium or something like that, a psychic that tries to come in and help them through it, I always appreciate that. And I just kind of wanted to make that note because this particular group, especially the lead, Dr. Lesh, I really liked her.
Yeah.
She was just very compassionate, I think, after she did, in fact, see the room, and she knew this was very much legit. I mean, the next day, what or like, I guess they were downstairs having coffee, and like she was
Yeah,
shaking like crazy. Like, okay, but they weren't gonna run out. They like I said, they were gonna take their job seriously, and it's okay. We're gonna deal with this and try to help this family. But even throughout the movie, because she was the one that ended up bringing in Zelda,
yeah.
so yeah, she. She was really a great character and a great help for the family. And I was a big fan of Ryan as well. I think your next scene talks about Mr. Marty, so I won't get too much into him, or I'll save my thoughts for Marty when we get back there. But no, just finishing that overall thought. If you didn't have any more thoughts for that. That was just a very key part for of that movie for me, and pretty much any of these kind of movies that I see, like I said, where there's a haunting or possession, anytime they bring in that professional who's there to help and see them through it, I always love that. And typically that character is one that I latch onto.
So on that, just a little bit on that point, but it's just that, because they're, like you said, again, they're there to be the skeptic, but they said when they find out this is legit, and so, okay, let's go.
Yeah, right. I mean, they had the equipment. This is what they did all their training for. Although she said she's actually a psychologist, because you can't actually get a degree in
Correct.
parapsychology, at least at that time. I don't know if you can now.
I
I
wouldn't
mean,
think so.
maybe online. You might be able to online, but not back in
Yeah.
82.
Okay, the next one is when Marty's like roaming around the house trying to get something, and he's eating a piece of fried chicken, and then he's looking at, and he has a pulls out a steak, puts it on the counter, and he hears some kind of squelchy sound, turns around and sees the steak kind of inching like an inchworm across the counter, and he puts his flashlight on it. You see it like explode in like worms and whatnot, and then he spits out the chicken, and then when he shines his light on it, he sees it's covered in maggots,
Ugh,
which
so
are
disgusting.
ah.
So
But then,
disgusting.
yeah, and so he might have thought might have eaten a few, and so he goes to the bathroom, or probably in this case the laundry room basin, vomits in it, and what ends up happening is that he sees the mirror there, and he's has this like pulling his face off effect, and is this that was like the number one, that's like a really bad like a really bad thing to experience for him, and it freaked him the hell out, and a net never to return. So on that point.
No, he sticks around that night, but then
Yeah.
he's gone the next day.
Yeah.
Yeah, talk about scenes that traumatized me when I was young. That pretty much did it.
And that effect, now you can tell it's like a rubber head, and but
Oh
for
my gosh, totally.
yeah, tell them
Oh, it
now,
was,
but for the time
yeah.
it was excellent. And I thought maybe they could have gotten the guy from that did the effects on the thing for that, might have been a little bit better.
Yeah, they you could tell they just had the prop dummy there, yeah, and somebody else's hands were coming in to do the tearing. But still, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty gruesome thought, anyway, nowadays, but back then, totally traumatizing. Yeah. And it's funny because as I was, I haven't watched this movie in years, and I couldn't remember that that happened to Marty. For some reason, I thought that was something that happened to Steven.
Oh, okay.
Because I remember that scene. Again, it sticks with you. And I knew at some point someone looks in a mirror and starts peeling their face off, and I always thought that that was Steven. I totally forgot about the Marty character. So in rewatching him, I was like, oh, this is Marty this all happens to. He, you know, he's the one that has the steak walking away from him and eating the maggot, which is, oh, can I just say, that's nothing more disgusting than maggots. Oh, my gosh. And to see that, and then, yeah, the peeling off of his face and just ripping it to shreds. It was an interesting twist because we hadn't seen anything like that to that point in the movie. So, yeah, it was just kind of weird how they decided to do that with Marty at that point, but I get it. I mean, there was I guess the writers figured that we need to get rid of Marty. We need to maybe grow some people out a little bit, show them that you know, there are definitely still more evil things at play, and we need to get rid of Marty as well. So like you said, Marty left and never came back.
Yeah, but later, but still, and then later on that night, you know, they see the ghosts, like the ones popping out of the mm-hmm. and playing with like the chandelier, and you see them all. You see when it's being recorded, and then you see after it's being played back, you see like the people in the halls of light, and you can see like the outlines of them on the screen, and it's just kind of, they have to they just kind of in wonder at what they're seeing, all these people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they found the old artifacts that mm-hmm. fell out of the ceiling, from the portal out of the ceiling. So now we kind of tie that in. Okay, well, these artifacts must belong to these beings that are in this particular state of limbo, which I can't remember. I know Dr. Lesh explain something to Diane, more so the little boy can understand, just kind of the difference about, you know, people dying, going to heaven, but maybe they don't get there because they don't know if they're dead or anything like that. But I don't think she really explained that they are actually trapped in the house. Maybe she did, I can't remember that. But I know later we get a more detailed explanation from Zelda.
Yeah.
So we actually find out who these beings are. And then much later in the movie, we actually find out a little bit more who these beings were, yeah. Because we see their old remains. So anyway, let's move on. Oh, one thing I wanted to say about Marty is that we didn't touch about. Marty also got bit. The first physical. Well, I don't want to say the first physical contact, because obviously, you know, the boy was attacked by a tree and Carol Ann got sucked into the TV. But kind of interesting. Because he was, you know, there was a lot of lights and flashing, and I think a wind knocked everybody over, I think, and it was like, all this time Marty was upstairs, as like, what's happening with Marty? And then he finally comes down when Dr. Lesh wants to go up to see the closet, and he says he got bit, and you see, like, the little teeth impressions on him. Didn't look like it drew any blood.
Yeah, but it's not a small mouth either. So.
No. And I think we see a little later what it came from, too.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. That thing could manifest itself however it wants to. But yeah, poor Marty. That's just one thing that I wanted to add, is that Marty got a raw deal in this. No pun intended with the raw meat. But anyway. Okay, so that was like you and me kind of both talking. Well, no. That was the parapsychology, and then you started talking about Marty.
You have Zelda.
Yeah. Zelda. Okay, that's my next point. Okay. Which I don't know.
Tangina is the character name. So.
Oh, I've been calling her Zelda, and that's the actress. Oh, my fault. Oh, well. Tangina is the... yeah, right. So my next point here is just going to be kind of about Tangina when she's speaking with Diane and the others after her assessment. you know, she comes into the house, looks around a little bit, and then she wants to speak with Diane. You know, she lets her know that her daughter's alive, and she's just, I'm paraphrasing here, of course, but basically where she is, she's in a world with these other beings that are trapped that don't really seem to want to harm her. They're actually, like, attracted to her life force, I think she says. Again, I'm paraphrasing. But which seems to be keeping them from the light that they need to move to, because it seems like Carol Ann has her own little light or something. Anything's just kind of attracting them to her. So it's more of a comforting talk to Diane, just letting her know, I guess, like, hey, this is where your daughter is. She's okay, you know, and then eventually she says, we're going to go get her. But after that, when she says, like, you know, now brace yourselves, or however she words it, which I think you quote it later, and everybody kind of gets in a little closer and, like, kneels down, Stephen has this look on her face like, what are you about ready to tell us? And then she just basically starts explaining to them that there's this other being there, which we kind of got that from Carol Ann when she was talking a little earlier in the movie, and she told them, like, somebody else is here. And she seems to be kind of freaked out by this person. At one point, she's yelling, get away from me, you know. Basically, this is when we find out that that is an evil spirit. It's not a poltergeist or one of these other spirits that are just kind of passing through, if you will. And then she actually refers to it as, you know, we know it as, oh, I know what she says. She says, you know, Carol Ann sees it as another child, but we know it as the Beast. Growing up Catholic, the Beast was just another way to refer to as, you know, the devil or something like that. So I don't know if Tangina was saying, like, oh, this is the devil, or it could just be whatever. If you don't want to think that there's a devil, then just think there's this evil spirit. That's all good. Anyway, there is this massive, there is this kind of very massive presence in there that is purely evil, that wants Carol Ann. And that's the one that's doing all these evil things. But I just like that moment when she's sitting there talking to them. And it's very riveting just to sit there and listen to her. Because like I said, that actor... the actress is very riveting the way she just kind of sits there and just explains everything. She has that high pitch, almost childlike voice. So that's another thing that's kind of like a little soothing and comforting to you as well. And I just really kind of got into that a little bit. That really draws you in, and that kind of sets you up for the last part of the movie. And then she finishes off by saying, like, now let's go get your daughter, which is, which leads to another really awesome sequence, her master plan to rescue Carol Ann from the other world, the underworld, if you will.
Yeah. For me, it's like, I could listen to Zelda Rubinstein.
Yeah.
just, I love that voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really doesn't fit. I mean, it kind of does fit her body and stature, you know, because she's a smaller person, but it doesn't, in a way, when you see her walking in and you think it's like something dubbed in, like, that's not her real voice, is it? But yeah. It was a really cool scene that impacted me. I really like that, how she kind of drew everyone in, their attention, and shit got real at that point.
Exactly.
They didn't really know what they were dealing with, and they bring in the expert, and she lets them know what they are dealing with, so. What do you got next?
Okay, this is during Carol Ann's rescue, is when Stephen pulls on the rope, you know, and the skull head with the flaming eyes comes out. It's just, and that scream he issues is just insane. You know, it's like he saw, like, looked into the very mouth of hell itself.
And yeah. Just, oh my God.
Screaming.
You think he'd be the one that would end up with white hair afterwards.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm with you. And that's kind of what I was insinuating after Marty got that bite, that, oh, I think we see what might have bit him later. You know, that mouth might have actually caused an injury like that, maybe.
Yeah.
But no, I'm with you. And again, just like the effects and how it kind of reminded me of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then there's other movies around that time, too. Really, really, really cool. Doesn't hold up, but it's really, really cool. Actually, reminded me a little bit of Ghostbusters, which I forgot to look to see if Edlund had anything to do with Ghostbusters or not. But like I said, it's the same kind of technology, so I'm sure there was a lot of people that, I don't want to say copied, but who knows, they probably worked together and had their same mentors and everything. So whoever started using these kind of a special effects, you know, it probably just caught on, and that's what people did. But yeah, it reminded me a lot of Ghostbusters as well.
Yeah, because the head was almost as tall as the door was.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like that kind of gives you an idea that head must have been at least 7 feet high. So just imagine seeing that right in front of you. It's like right in your face.
Yeah, right. And it's funny because, I mean, you talk about this, but it makes me think of like the whole plan of how to go get her. I mean, she's in this other dimension, and they do the test tennis balls. And then they throw the rope into the closet, and it comes out to Ryan down in the living room. It just seems like a little crazy and a little too simple, but it's also a lot of fun too. And yeah, because Steven's like freaked out because up until this point, it was like, tell her not to go. I'm losing track now. Tell her to go. Tell her not to go into the light. Yeah. You know, tell Carol Ann not to walk into the light at this point. And then she starts telling everybody at that point, you know, when Diane's already in there. Tangina?
Yes.
Tangina, sorry. I just want to call her Zelda. Tangina says, you know, starts telling, she's actually speaking to the spirits in there, you know, go to the light. That's whatever. It's a safe place. You're all welcome. You know, in her typical, you know, Tangina voice. You know, you're all welcome. And then like Steven's like freaking out. Like, what? You said don't go to the light. What are you doing? He's like all ticked off. So then he starts pulling on the rope. And yeah, the beast did not like that at all. And we got to see Beast's ugly face.
Yeah, and what I'm thinking it was a distraction for the beast. To be able to allow Diane to grab Carol Ann and go out the exit.
Oh, okay. Okay, I see what you're saying there.
Because falling from the ceiling down to the floor, even though it's carpeted and padded, it's like, that's got a sting. And covered in pink slime, too. But
Yeah, that's true. Okay, that's clever. I didn't actually put that together. I just thought she was trying to get the other spirits to go. But I'm thinking
that maybe what Tangina had planned for it. So
okay,
no confirmation, but that,
yeah, that's, you know. No, it's a clever thought. I mean, yeah, I wouldn't argue with that point. Sounds like a nice point there. I mean, I actually don't have this down, but we can just both kind of start talking about the ending of the movie here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Final night.
Yeah, the final night. Because after Diane and Carol Ann are rescued, you think everything's going to be fine, I guess, even though, you know, there was no real exorcism, I don't suppose. She was just rescued, but Tangia did say the house was clean.
Mm-hmm.
You thought everything was going to be okay, but yet they were moving anyway.
Yeah.
Steven wanted to get the heck out of there, which I think is a couple days too late, but whatever. Well, I guess you need to get Carol Ann. You could always bring the TV with you. Anyway, so, they were like packing, and it was kind of a weird move because it seemed like he wanted to get out that night. You know, he didn't want to stay there. They said, we don't want to stay there that night. And then he went off to work because he had to, whatever, close things out with his boss, Teague, you know, clean up his desk and I guess, you know, let him know that he was quitting and why. I don't know if he's going to tell him why, but at least letting him know he was quitting. And but then later on that night, it seemed like they were definitely going to stay there because not everything was packed. So that little part, I was kind of confused in the movie, and I thought might have been a little plot hole, but whatever. Because like the kids had some toys packed, but then everything else seemed to be pretty much out, and they still had, I don't know, a lot of stuff out. I think, especially in like, you know, Diane's bedroom, she's getting ready to color her hair to get rid of that gray. From being in the underworld. And yeah, I just didn't really get that, why it seemed like they could so easily stay there that night.
Yeah.
But hey, what you wanted to talk about the next part, though, that happened in that.
When she's being when the like the door the attack kind of I want to say when the attack starts again, Diane gets attacked and she tries to go to the kids' room and she gets like shocked by the door. And this one, like a energy comes up in front of the door blocking her, and we see this like white skeleton thing with like what seemed like 18 foot tall legs and arms, this floating skeleton head. It was actually terrifying for me as as a kid when I watched it the first time, and the roar and the growl it gave, that was like the top, and that has to be one of my personal favorites of all time for this. Even though it's a dated effect, the sound and just, but at the time, that sticks with your 11-year-old, 11-year-old brain, and it's there too. And I still find it a little bit, a little bit scary.
Yeah, I'm thinking I never made it that far into the movie at that point. Because I think that was right after the clown attack, which is also the other point we want to talk about. But no, that particular skeleton, yeah, I didn't actually remember that part, because I think after the clown, I was pretty much done with Poltergeist back in the day.
And one of the other points on this is when I think this is after Diane goes swimming with the corpses in the pool, comes back up and tries to get to the hall and goes down the hallway, and you see the hallway kind of making having this extending effect.
Yeah, that was
And,
actually really cool. I really got a kick out of that.
I remember that effect. I wonder if I remember right, that effect is produced by pulling back the camera while at the same time doing a zoom in. So it kind of has really weird effect. And it was done in Vertigo. So it has this effect of like the wall, like zooming in on the foreground while the background is going away from you. So it just has this really weird effect on it. So no special effects really needed.
That's pretty interesting that that's how they did that. No, I did like that for sure. That effect there. And the whole bodies in the ground or coming out of the swimming pool, that was just absolutely terrifying. And do you know that, well, I don't think it was 100% confirmed, but Steven Spielberg claims that he told the actress who played Diane, her name is
Joseph Williams.
Bobby Joe, Mary
Joe
Jo,
Beth.
Joe
Joe
Beth
Beth.
Williams. Sorry, he told her that those were actually real corpses. And I tried to research this a little bit, and I did see like on other places online that he was actually quoted at saying like, yeah, the to do fake skeletons would be more expensive. So I don't know if this is just like another part of this movie's lore or whatever, but I did see it in several places that apparently that those were real skeletons that came up. I mean, I don't know how they could. I know they can't get away with doing that kind of stuff now, but maybe back in 82 they could do that. I don't know. Go to a cemetery and just, grab some corpses. I have no idea.
I don't really buy it,
You
but
don't
because
buy it?
well, it's like even like is desecration worth that much? But
Yeah, I don't know. I know. I'm just talking about it now. I'm thinking, like, you know what? I'm sure Steven Spielberg was just pulling people's legs. But then there's just that little part of it that's like, hey, early 80s. You never know what prop people might come across. I don't know. But no, anyway, whether they were fake or real, that was just a pretty scary scene. And then all the caskets start popping out of the ground, which earlier we hear a com there's a conversation between Teague and Steven, and he's explaining to him that he can move him to a new home in phase five of their development project. Cuesta Verde?
What's the word?
Cuesta Verde. Just want to make sure I was pronouncing that right. And Steven's like, oh great, not much room for a pool because there's a cemetery right here. And he's like, oh, we can move it, you can move it down, there's a cemetery 5 minutes down the road, people can visit. Basically, and then he says, like, oh, you know, we've done it before. And Steven's like, what are you talking about? He's like, oh, right down there, you know, apparently. So apparently that it was, this is when we find that at that point we find out, okay, so the houses are built on top of a cemetery. But at this point is when we find out that they didn't actually move any bodies. They didn't relocate that cemetery at all. They just relocated headstones. So then that, you know, now you have all these bodies popping out of the ground, skeletons flying everywhere, corpses, badly decomposed corpses just flopping all over the place.
Yeah. Now, can one thing I would say to that is, like, can you imagine the criminal penalties for that? If you know, it's like, because you're just like, if you were supposed to move the bodies, imagine how many angry families you would have
Oh my gosh,
suing you,
yeah. For
and then you
sure.
would have to identify every single one of those and move them, so which would probably tear down most of the homes in that neighborhood.
Oh yeah. Well, actually, as the which I know we can always jump back to the clown, but as the movie comes to an end and the family is driving away, I mean, you see chaos is now gone past just the Freelings' home. It seems like there maybe some caskets are popping out from somebody else's yards, or fire hydrants are exploding. There's like fires happening all over the place. Cars are getting overturned. So you kind of get the feeling that this is the end of this development, as you know it, I believe. So yeah, but I'm with you. Yeah, that's pretty much a horrible thing, and I don't think any kind of developer would be able to recover from that at all.
Oh, but we got to go back to the clown.
We're going back to the clown. Let's go back to the clown. Again, from rewatching this, I actually was fearful for a few minutes that I got an edited version because you see the clown in the beginning of the movie when the boy is trying to fall asleep and the clown's creeping him out in the chair and he throws the jacket or whatever, the Star Wars jacket with Chewbacca's face on it, throws it on there and everything. And the clown ends up in the closet and get, you know, when Carol Ann gets sucked in there. But then the next time you see the clown is when you mentioned the parapsychologists go in there and the clown's laughing and spinning. So I'm like, oh no, did the attack get, am I watching a version where the attack was cut out? And I'm like, what's going on? And that's when I like looked up online real quick and, it comes at the end of the movie, and I'm like, oh, okay. I didn't remember that. I thought the clown attacked in the very beginning, but yeah. I'll let you continue this point, but the clown freaked me out. Even went before it came to life.
Yeah, and on that final night, Robbie tries to, like, he throws his jacket up, try he throws his jacket at it and misses, and tries to cover it up. And when he wakes up later, he looks up at the chair, and the clown's gone. So, and then he looks, and then he's thinking, well, let me look under the bed. Okay, nothing there. And when he pops up, it's right there behind him, and starts laughing, and then wraps its arm around his neck and pulls him underneath the bed, which is horrible.
I jumped a little bit because I thought, like I said, I didn't quite remember it. I thought he was going to look under the bed and it was going to like be looking back at him. But what he looked in and there was nothing. And then he sat up and it was there. I did do a little like, oh boy, there it is.
Yeah, and I think that the way they did that effect was, they did that in reverse to have that effect of the clown wrapping its arm around his neck, is that they had it wrapped around his neck and then just pulled it away. And so when you run that in reverse, it looks like it's wrapping its arm around his neck.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. But he does beat the clown. He ends up ripping it to shreds. Why would he have that clown in his room to begin with? It obviously bothered him. I don't know. I don't want to say there's so many things, but there are a couple of things in this movie. I'm like, why are things just bothering Robbie now? I mean, they've lived in there for like a couple years, like more than five, because I think we heard Teague say that Carol Ann was born there. So she, they've been in here for a while. It was just like, why is this stuff bothering him now? Is this the first storm they had where the tree was actually bothering him? I don't know. I know it's all for the sake of the movie and things like that, but that clown's a no-go for me. No. Why would you have that anyway? There's nothing fun about
That's
that
creepy
clown
at
at
all.
all. He's just creepy in general. But no, it's probably one of those scenes that really freaked me out when I was younger. And I just probably made me hate this movie and not want to watch the whole thing through. I know I watched it a couple times back in the day, you know, up until a point when I was, I guess, probably to get, like, maybe like you said, 11, 12, 13 maybe or something like that. But some of those things were just like, a no, thank you. The whole face peeling thing and then the clown. It was like, ah, this stuff is too much. But now you look at it and it's all fun. It's all funny. And my 13-year-old didn't mind it. He was he got a kick out of it, actually. So,
well, he's probably been exposed to worse.
You know what? He's actually, of my two sons, he's actually the one that can tolerate more stuff. We've been to, like, haunted houses and things like that where they jump out and scare you, and he actually did pretty well. So, and he can tolerate more stuff on TV. But, yeah, no, it's just he's not as sensitive, I should say. So. Yeah, that's pretty much. Oh, but we have to, if we're done with the clown, there's the last part of the, well, not the very last part, but the last end of the movie you wanted to mention, the last part there.
Yeah, when the after the Freelings leave, you see the house completely collapse in on itself,
mm-hmm.
into the portal.
Implosion, up in the, yes.
Yeah, implodes into that portal.
And where does it go? To the other world? To nowhere? I don't know. To nothingness?
Yeah, probably to nowhere.
To nowhere. Did you see any of the... Did you see both sequels?
A while back, yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing the sequels. I don't think I did. I know they're not as good as the first one. Nowhere near as good,
yeah. There's a creepy priest, I think, in the second one.
Yeah, I did read about that when I was doing some research. I don't know about the third one at all, but I might want to take a look at them and the remake too. Mm-hmm. Did you say you saw the remake, or did I ask you
once? And it was like I wasn't too satisfied with it.
Huh, okay. Did they bring the clown back?
Yes.
Oh, that's right. He's on the cover. I think when I was on IMDb and I saw it, he's on the poster of it, and I'm like, oh no! Why would they do that? Is there anything else you wanted to say about scenes, or can we move on to just some other notes we have?
Yeah, I think we can move on.
Okay. What do you got first?
Okay, I have to mention once again, the soundtrack from the very beginning. You know, when the you see one of Steven's friends riding the kid's bike with a case of beer on him, and mm-hmm. you see this like a happy little... You know, a happy little tune trying to cover just kind of the everyday life on the, like, this is a weekend day because they're watching football, and but it's just covering everyday life and showing what's going on, mm-hmm. up, you know, and the other side of that, all the music that happens with, you know, all the attacks, the ghosts that when they, you see some some lighter portions when they're looking at the screens with the ghosts, the music accompaniment of this is almost like a character in itself in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, the score is absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just with you 100%. Every intense scene, the music, when we see the different spirits float, like when they were floating from the upstairs to the downstairs, when everybody was there, the parapsychology team was there, just that the score that was playing, it was just so, you know, dramatic and, you know, uplifting, yet had that little twist of, you know, supernaturalness to it. It was just, it's hard to describe, but, and again, it reminded me a lot of, Indiana Jones. Now, I know Goldsmith didn't do Indiana Jones, but I'm wondering if, he kind of like took a little bit from that, because who did the music for that? Williams, right? John Williams,
I believe so.
Yeah, did the music for Indiana Jones. So I'm wondering if, you know, he kind of followed a little bit in Williams' footsteps. It'd be interesting to look that up and see if he had any kind of influence there. But definitely throughout the whole movie, though, you know, there's the uplifting moments, like the introduction of the movie, you know, when the dad's coming home from work, you know, the credit sequence and everything like that. It just sounds like it's a nice, normal, everyday family movie. And then when the storms come and things like that, everything just gets all dark and ominous and everything. I'm with you. The music is a character within itself. and I love it. And Goldsmith did a great job. I was going to talk a little bit about the curse of Poltergeist. There is a lore around Hollywood that the movie franchise is cursed based on several cast members' deaths. Now, tragically, Dominique Dunn, who played Dana in this movie, Poltergeist, she was strangled by her ex-boyfriend 5 months after Poltergeist. She died several days later. Another actor from the movie was murdered in 2009, Lou Perryman. He's credited as playing Pugsley, which is one of the construction workers. Now, I didn't actually hear that name, but I think it's the guy that leaned in and was drinking the coffee and tasted the stuff she had cooking in the pot. You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I think that's Lou Perryman. Apparently, he was murdered by someone by an axe in 2009, which is really, really crazy. And then, of course, Heather O'Rourke died suddenly in 1988 from a congenital stenosis of the intestine, complicated by septic shock. She was being treated for Crohn's disease during the filming of Poltergeist 3. And then shortly after the filming, I think they said in February of 88, it was, she ended up going into a cardiac arrest and died from her stomach issues. And then you had mentioned Kane in Poltergeist 2. Now, he had died from stomach cancer, which wasn't really sudden, but that was after filming that. And then Will Sampson, who played the Native American shaman in also Poltergeist 2, he died after a heart and lung transplant. So while not all of these are, would you consider tragic deaths, some were just, you know, natural causes or stomach or other ailments. There is some lore saying that there is some sort of curse to the movie or being in the movie. However, there's so many other actors and actresses that are still alive and have had no problems. So, and that's what that's what I dug up about it. So I don't know how much of a curse it is, but I mean, there's certain some tragic deaths. I think anytime you have, you know, that main character in Carol Ann, and she ends up dying at a young age, I guess there's always the people that are going to think like, oh my gosh, did it have to do with playing that character? But the other things I think were just freak incidents and acts of nature, not nature, but you know, just a normal course of human ailments and things like that.
Yeah, and Dominique Dunn's.
Well, that one, I would say the fact that it happened so close after the movie, that would probably be the one that would make you think like, holy shit, you know what is this about here? But all right, so the next point I wanted to make was just some other interesting facts that I dug up. Drew Barrymore was actually considered for the role of Carol Ann, but producer Steven Spielberg wanted someone more angelic. It was Barrymore's audition for this role, however, that landed her the part of Gertie in E.T. in 1982. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Oh, I got another one. Stephen King was briefly approached to write the screenplay. It would have been the first written by King directly for the screen, but the parties could not agree to the terms. That would have had some interesting twist in it, I thought. Oh, here's something about the clown, Jerry. The clown puppet used in the film is on display in Planet Hollywood in Caesar's Palace, Las Vegas.
Nice.
I will not be visiting that. Let's see, there's another thing about E.T. here. Steven Spielberg offered Toby Hopper the script for E.T., the extraterrestrial, but when... I'm sorry, I said Hopper, but it's Hooper. But when Hooper declined, Spielberg gave him the not-yet-written script for this film instead, and he directed E.T. the extraterrestrial. Wow, there's lots of little twists and turns and ties to E.T. here. I know they came out at the same time, both being Spielberg movies, but it's kind of interesting how you have the different tie-ins. Did you hear the Wilhelm scream?
Yes, I did.
It's funny when that comes up. You're like, Wilhelm. Again, of course, the Star Wars very Star Wars was very popular around that time too, which has several Wilhelms, I think.
It has one in every, I think it has one in every movie.
This is one of the few Steven Spielberg films not featuring music by John Williams. There we go. So I mentioned about how there was a lot of similarities I found to Indiana Jones with the John Williams music. But of course, as we mentioned, it was not John Williams. Both of the, here's my last point here that I'm going to make. Both of the terrors that plagued Robbie came from Steven Spielberg's own fears as a child. A fear of clowns and a tree outside his window. So I think, you know, we all have, we all remember those scary shadows that would be outside the window at night. So I don't think that's anything out of the ordinary. The clowns, however, no, no.
Yeah. Well, there is a phenomenon, you know, called pareidolia, where you see shapes and but mostly faces in random things.
Oh, okay.
So if you look at something and you see a face in it, you know, that's your pareidolia in your brain.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Yeah. But I forget if it's like something that comes from infancy about recognizing, you know, faces that, you know, cause that.
Okay. Huh. That's really interesting. I didn't even know that was a thing, but now I do know. All right, let's move on here. On to quotes. I don't have many. You have some. Why don't you go ahead first?
Okay, we got to go with the number one quote from in this film is, "They're here."
Of course.
Which is, yeah, which is number 69 on AFI's top 100 movie quotes.
Mm-hmm.
It better not ever get knocked off that list.
Oh, I don't think it will. That's just so iconic.
Mm-hmm.
The first one I have, which is not as iconic, but it did make me laugh a little bit. I actually don't have it written down here, but it's when I talked about when they were testing the tennis balls and the second tennis ball came through the roof and Marty catches it and goes, "Kiss my ass." Yeah. It's ball number two. I just thought that was funny because, you know, how's that stuff supposed to happen? How are you supposed to throw a tennis ball in one room and it come out the other? What's your next one?
Okay, next one is after Marty's night with the, you know, pulling his own face off. Dr. Lesh in the morning says, "Marty won't be coming back."
No, he won't. But another line that I like, which follows that, is when she says, "But I will be coming back." I like that one too.
And I'll be bringing help.
Yeah, and she'll bring help. Yes, please bring help. There's an exchange between Diane and Tangina,
yes,
outside the, I can't believe I loaded her Zelda all in these notes. Oh, well. It's shorter than Tangina. Between Diane and Tangina outside the closet, when they're debating who's going to go in for Carol Ann, and I don't have it word for word here, but basically they're just going back and forth. You know, Tangina says she's going to go, and Diane saying, "Oh, she won't come to you. I'm going to go." And Tangina says something else, and she was like, "Oh, I know." Tangina says, "You've never done this before." And Diane goes back and says, "Well, neither have you." And Tangina just looks at her like, "You're right. You go." I just thought that was funny. Like you said, everything Tangina said, so quotable. You could just put every single her line in for quotes. That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's that little bit of humor Spielberg injects into his movies. You know, and even though he was only, you know, tasked with the production of this, but I'm thinking that got in due to Spielberg. Because you notice a lot of that in his movies. There's some, like, in the midst of this, there's a small laugh. Mm-hmm. And Raiders of the Lost Ark did that handily.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that reminds me of when, Sala and Indy are on top of the pit. Looking down at the ass, and Sala goes, "Ass, very dangerous. You go first." Yeah, you got a point there. Yeah, you gotta have some humor. Gotta throw in the humor where you can. Give people the chuckle while they're on the edge of their seats with their butt cheeks clenched. you got another one?
My next quote is Tangina's, Tangina's main line about when she's addressing the group, and we talked about this before, after saying your daughter's alive and in the house, and she says, "Now hold on to yourselves. There's one more thing. A terrible presence is in there with her, so much rage, so much betrayal, and I've never sensed anything like it. I don't know what hovers over this house, but it was strong enough to punch a hole in this world and take your daughter away from you. It keeps Carolyn very close to it and away from the spectral light. It lies to her. It says things only a child can understand. To her, it is simply another child. To us, it is the beast. Now let's go get your daughter."
I'm telling you, that's why it was one of my scenes. Just everything she said there was just so riveting. Like I said, I was on the edge of my seat just saying like, "Oh boy, here we go." And she delivered it so well. But no, that whole her whole line, all her lines there were excellently written, I think. And really draws you in. And the casting was great. To have her in there. She, like I said, way back when we were talking about cast notes, she stole the show, I think. And nominated for what, best supporting actress, I think, for Saturn. Yeah, it was for Saturn. So for her, whatever, 10 minutes of screen time, 15 minutes
And
of screen time.
yeah, for me, it's like she makes that part of the movie so much
Oh
better.
yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah, it wouldn't have, if they would have had the, I almost called her Beatrice, but Doctor, that's the actress's name, Dr. Lesh. If they just would have had like Dr. Lesh play that like part the whole way through without separating it to another character, if they just would have had a player, it wouldn't have been the same. Even though I really like Dr. Lesh and she had some good things to say too, you needed the Tangina. You needed that. The last, well, I think the last one I had kind of just piggyback onto yours, where she starts off talking to Diane right away, saying your daughter is alive and in the house, in this house. So yeah, that's kind of the last one I have. So you go ahead and round out yours. I think you got like two more, maybe. Oh, three more.
Three more. I have after getting Carol Ann back, Tangina does a little primping in front of the camera and says, "This house is clean."
But it really isn't.
It really isn't,
She was wrong.
But after for years after that, after I would finish finish doing the chores around the house, and
Oh
I would
God.
say, "This house is clean."
Oh my gosh, Jerry, that's awesome. Oh yeah, I wonder how many people would appreciate that. That's so good.
And many people I know, aside from our personal group, would not get that joke.
Oh man, that's so funny that I could hear you saying that. That's so funny. All right, good.
And next to last one is Steven talking to his boss, Teague, when realizing what happens. He says, "You son of a bitch, you moved the cemetery, but you left the bodies, didn't you? You only moved the headstones." And then does this, why? And just the way he delivers that line is just like in ra like rage and damn borderline insanity at Teague. And when we see the shot of James Cairn's eyes being lit up, and he if you don't know who James Cairn is, he has he's these bright blue eyes. And it really, and he can really emote it, and he was just like this, you kind of felt the terror of what he was feeling, like he was about to be killed or something.
No, yeah, he played that well. And then, of course, a body almost fell on him, too. Fell like right by him. Should have fell on top of him. It should have been like Indiana Jones, not all these Indiana Jones callbacks, but when all the skeleton bodies fell on top of Marion. Remember that down at when they were getting out of the pit of snakes, and all the bodies ended up falling on her. They should have had something like that happen to Teek. That would have been nice. Maybe with a snake coming out of the mouth. Just like, no, it's all right. What's your last one?
Last one is when Dana returns home after her dinner date. She sees what's going on, and I think her top scream of the movie is, "What is happening?" And with that piercing shriek to
Oh gosh. Yeah. Oh
it. I
my
can't.
gosh, yeah.
Yeah, I can't do it, but.
Nah. All right, so that wraps up quotes. Let's move on to the where are they now. I'll start off with Toby Hooper. He died in 2017, moved on to direct for both TV and movies. He did direct the sequel to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, also Life Force and Spontaneous Combustion. His last credit directing was for the 2013 Dijin. I don't know how to pronounce that. It's capital D, capital J, I, N, N. Dijin, maybe? Maybe the D silent. Maybe it says Jin. I don't know. Anyway, that was his last directing credit. Basically stayed in horror throughout most of his career. But obviously, I would say this and Texas Chainsaw Massacre are his most two popular films.
Okay, Craig T. Nelson went on to be in Silkwood, All the Right Moves, The Osterman Weekend, Action Jackson, Born on the 4th of July, Turner and Hooch, The Devil's Advocate, Wag the Dog, and especially, we all know him from The Incredibles. And then he also did Family Stone, Blaze of Glory, Soul Surfer, and the next Incredibles. And TV shows include Paper Dolls, Chicago Story. His number one, what he's most known, I think he's most known for other than this movie, the TV series Coach.
Mm-hmm.
He's also in CSI New York, Monk, Hawaii Five-0, and currently now in Young Sheldon.
Oh, I didn't know that was currently what he was doing. Yeah, I watched a little bit of Coach back in the day. I know All the Right Moves, I hated him. And All the Right Moves. he plays not a nice coach, but so he's still acting, went on to a great career. Pretty cool. All right, I will take on Jo Beth Williams. She has a crazy amount of credits. Her film highlights include The Big Chill, American Dreamer, Teachers. TV shows include Judging Amy, Las Vegas, 24, Criminal Minds, Dexter, NCIS, Heart of Dixie, Scandal, Rizzoli and Isles, and The Good Doctor.
Yeah, and I kind of limited it to what I could recognize because there's a ton of stuff I don't recognize on that list or I've never seen.
Oh, I'm sorry. That might be Rizzoli and Isles?
Isles. Rizzoli and Isles is
correct. All right. Sorry. Okay, you can go on.
Yeah, Dominique Dunn, sadly, Poltergeist was her only feature film. And she did some episodes of TV after Poltergeist before her untimely death. But she was she was supposed to be one of the main characters in the miniseries V. I don't know if you remember that one.
Yeah, I remember it.
When she was murdered and another actress, I forget her name at the moment, took her place.
Yeah, we had talked about it. It was so tragic. So tragic how she was killed. Just really not fair anytime anybody that young goes.
Yeah.
Speaking of dying young, Heather O'Rourke was in several TV shows. She was on a season of Happy Days. Wow, a whole season? I don't remember that.
Yeah, she was.
Maybe it was the last season. Huh?
Yeah, she was the daughter of Fonzie's girlfriend.
Oh, wow, okay.
Linda Pearl, if my brain...
Oh, okay, yeah. Webster, Finder of Lost Loves, and the second and third Poltergeist films. And she died at the age of 12 from, like we mentioned, intestinal stenosis and cardiopulmonary arrest.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Oliver Robbins was in Poltergeist 2, Killer Legends, which is a documentary, and I believe that had to be... with his Poltergeist character, Celebrity Crush, which he wrote and directed, and Rideshare Killer.
Zelda Rubinstein, two other Poltergeist movies, and then in Picket Fences, she did die in 2010.
Yeah, and she had, way too many credits to note here, and I limited to like what I really knew.
Mm-hmm. That's fine.
I remember watching Picket Fences, you know, when it was on from time to time, and I remember seeing her in that.
Yeah, and I know I've seen her in other things too. I just can't, I can't place it. I mean, she's one of those people that you think was on everything in the 80s because she just stands out, like I said, with that voice. And I know her, you know, her voiceovers for cartoons and different animations. I'm sure she did a bunch of those too.
And finally, we have James Caron, who was also in Return of the Living Dead, a personal favorite. Piranha.
So fun.
Yeah. He was also in Wall Street, a very memorable character in that one. 13 Days and The Pursuit of Happiness as Will Smith's boss. And he died in 2018, which is sad because I really like him as an actor.
Yeah, I remember him from Return of the Living Dead. That's such a fun one. I'm thinking about wanting to cover that one at some point too.
Yeah, and I have to hand it to James Caan because he plays, such a great jerk. He's a great jerk. And also plays, as you see in The Pursuit of Happiness, a very kind soul too. Can play both.
I've actually never seen that. It's one of those things that have been on my list to try to watch, but it's just never I've just never gotten to see it.
Well, I highly recommend that one. So.
Yeah, like I said, I've heard it was good, and just one of those things. You know, that might be a good date night movie. Sit down and watch that with my wife, because I don't think she's ever seen it either. Okay, let's move on to At the Box Office. I had mentioned before, Poltergeist was released June 4th, 1982, and was the ninth highest grossing film in 82, bringing in about 76.6 million. Opening weekend, it grossed almost 6.9 million and finished third behind Rocky III, which was in its second week, and a certain other movie you and I are fans of, Jerry, that came out that same week. Can you name it? We actually were thinking about covering it.
See, June 82, that should be Star Trek 2.
That is correct. That was number
Yes.
one at the box office that week. Yeah,
And
Jerry and I are going to be covering that at some point. Not too sure when. We were going to do it for December, or excuse me, we were going to do it for September, but plans just kind of fell through. So now we're going to revisit it at a later point, because that's all these 82 movies are going through their 40th anniversary. So it'd be nice to hit one every now and again. But if we don't, that's okay, because we still love them and we'll appreciate them when we cover them.
Yeah, and I was able they did do a one of those fan like a I forget what the company is like. I bought the tickets on Fandango. I'm thinking Fandango, but the Fathom Events. Thank you. Fathom Events had a 40th anniversary release of Star Trek 2 that I was able to watch in the so that was the first time I was able to watch it in the theater.
Oh, you did go. Oh,
Yeah.
great. Yeah,
I
I
was
saw a
able to make
long
it.
time ago it was going to have a limited release, and I was hoping to go see it, but it just didn't happen. So I'm glad you went to. How was it on the big screen?
Awesome.
Yeah, I
Even
bet.
better, even better on the big screen.
All right. We'll save some other stuff for the podcast when we cover it, but make sure you keep your notes fresh. Okay, we're going to move on to listener feedback. And can I just say that this is like the most feedback I've had for any podcast. And I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you for everyone who wrote in. I don't know what I did differently this time. I don't know. I mean, I put out the teaser post around the same time, but I don't know. I guess it's just the super popular movie, and it's a great time of year to be watching these kind of old school horror movies, thriller movies. Hate to call it a horror movie because it was only rated PG, but anyway, still, it's a great time of year to revisit movies like this. So I
Yeah,
just want to what's up?
I would say thriller.
Thriller. Yeah, thank you. yeah, I just want to thank everybody, and I'll thank you again probably once we're done. But I'm going to kick it off. All these are courtesy of Facebook. We didn't get any emails this week. Wendy from over at Podcastica, our friends at Podcastica, sent us a message, in particular Wendy. She says, "We were just talking about this movie on Handmaid's Tale. Scared the bejesus out of me. Ruined clowns for the rest of my life." Agreed.
And I can see why.
Yeah, agreed, Wendy. 100%. Thanks for writing in.
Okay, next we have Barbie, who is a mutual friend. She says, "This was my first truly scary movie. As a kid, the big, crooked, menacing-looking tree in the neighborhood was labeled a poltergeist tree and was only the object of dares, never climbed for fun. That movie validated my fears about what's under the bed and in closets at night. And gave me a great excuse to get rid of a clown doll my aunt gave me that I never liked anyway." See, I haven't seen it in decades, but some scenes are just burned into my mind.
I'm 100% with that, Barbie. There's just those couple of scenes that you're like, yep, Guy peeling the face. Yep, clown strangling the kid. It's just, these are things that are just burned into your mind forever. Okay, and next we have our mutual friend Daphne from the Run for Your Lives podcast. She wrote over. I remember this movie and the franchise for not only being so creepy, but also for the curse associated with it, including multiple cast members passing away during and after the filming. Beware of clowns. Heather O'Rourke was equally adorable and unnerving as Carol Ann. Zelda Rubinstein was perfect as Tangina. Agreed, agreed, and agreed, Daphne. And we talked a little bit about the curse. Daphne was one of those people to say, make sure you talk about the curse. And I did. I hope I did it some justice. I don't know if there's any other things that eluded me, but hey, if anybody knows of anything else that has to do with this movie that I might have missed, please just write in and go ahead and let us know, and I'll read it on a future podcast and make that adjustment.
Next, we have Mark from Adrenaline Cinema. We both know him, who writes, "Wow, this movie scared the poop out of me when it came out. That bathroom scene when the guy peels his face scared me to the core as a kid, and it gets me sometimes as an adult. It was a scary, crazy movie, but well done by Tobe Hooper. They say that Spielberg actually filmed some shots in the movie. I wonder if that is true. That clown scene was freaky, and the tree was menacing." Again, agree and agree.
There's a trend going here. That's interesting about Spielberg filming shots. I don't know. I'm thinking he was really wrapped up with E.T. That's what I'm thinking. I think he. I don't know. Who knows how Hollywood works? But that'd be interesting to find out if he did actually film some shots.
Well, yeah. Well, if it came out in June, you'd figure they're filming in summer of 81, like summer to fall of 81, they're doing this, so.
Yeah, and E.T. came out.
In 82 as well.
Yeah, I think a little later in July, because once that came out, that like just held the box office. So it wasn't out yet when this movie came out. Who knows? I mean, I know this was filmed in California. I'm assuming E.T. was filmed in California as well. We're going to cover E.T. at some point, by the way. That was a possibility of being covered as well in October, but it didn't happen. But we are going to cover E.T. because that's one of the greatest movies of all time. Okay, next we have Joan. Actually, the first movie I remember seeing with my cousins. I got to meet them for my senior trip. Very cool. Thanks for writing in, Joan. That's a pretty cool memory to have. And you're the first person to not mention any kind of scary clowns.
And on that point, we have Weasel. That clown still gives me the creeps.
Okay, one person doesn't mind clowns. All right. And we have Eric wrote in classic movie. Agreed. Thank you, Eric, for writing in.
We have Miguel saying, "I have it on 4K Blu-ray," which is something I would like to see.
Yeah, and you know what? I bet you that's got a bunch of good extras and maybe even talk a little bit more about the curse. So, hey, Miguel, if you're listening, let us know. Write in and let me know if there's anything else you can add. And go ahead and take this last one.
Yeah, and finally, our mutual friend Greg says, "My comments are nope, 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 and nope."
Again, probably has something to do with the creepy clown. But actually, I don't know. Does Greg not do scary stuff? I don't know. He has to do scary stuff. I don't know.
I
Maybe
think.
just not. I mean, there's different kinds of scary. There's like the horror scary, where you have the killers and stuff. But then some people are freaked out by the supernatural stuff. But hey, it's fun, Greg. Come on, come on, come on. All right. Well, thanks again for all that feedback. Again, that was the best feedback we've ever had. And I'm like smiling from ear to ear. I want to say I wish I had that every week because then it wouldn't be so special, but it's always going to be special. So thank you, fans, for writing in. And please continue to do so. All right, let's move on to our closing and send off. Reminder, please rate and review the podcast to help us grow. The more ratings and reviews the podcast has, the higher we get on the search list. So please do so if you haven't. It'd be greatly appreciated. And if you'd like to recommend us to any of your 80s loving friends, we're on Apple and Google Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, iHeart, Audible, pretty much everywhere you can listen to podcasts, you can hear us. And you can also visit us at www.watchtheendthe80spodcast.com. Get a full list there. Also, if you want to provide feedback, like all our people did today, you can do that a few ways. You can actually send an email to watchedinthe80spodcast@gmail.com. You can send either an actual written email or make a recording and send the file right to us via email, and I can pop it right into the show and play it. Or you can follow us on Facebook at Watched It in the 80s Podcast, on Twitter at WIIT80S Podcast, and on Instagram at Watched It in the 80s Podcast. I put out teaser posts, and you can always comment there, like that seems to be what everybody else did this time.
And please check out the other podcasts on the Pirate Core Entertainment Network, including Adrenaline Cinema Podcast and the Run for Your Lives Podcast. Next week, they will be talking the 2017 It Chapter 1 as they continue with their It-tober.
Yes, they did the old It from the early 1990s, which I do remember, Parts 1 and 2, and now they're doing the newer It, Parts 1 and 2.
Yeah, 1990 was the year.
Was it in 90? Yeah, I do remember the miniseries watching it as a kid. Pretty scary stuff.
Yeah. I loved it.
I haven't even seen the new It because I knew the old one, you know, was pretty significantly scary, and I didn't want to see it redone and made to be even more scary. So I haven't even seen the new It, but the old one's tons of fun. Love the actors. Gosh, yeah. John Ritter's in that. Mm-hmm. Oh, so many people. So many people are in that.
Richard Thomas, Ted Reed.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Harry Anderson.
Tim Curry as It. Tim Curry, yeah. Great movie. I guess 2017. Did you see the new one?
I saw them both opening days.
Good?
I'll put it to you this way. It's like when I was finished, I took some time off of work to watch. I took the half a day off work to go watch It on its first day. Uh-huh. I was so happy with it, I damn near cried.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Well, that's a good suggestion for listeners out there. If you haven't seen it, why don't you go see it? Why don't you revisit it from 2017? And then you can listen to Paik and Daphne over there. And on Adrenaline Cinema, Mark's last episode, as we before mentioned, was Omega Man with Jerry. And next up is Speed with Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock. No, they're not going to be doing it with Mark. they are the stars of Speed. But guess who is doing it with Mark? Kelly is going to be with him for that. Kelly, a one-time guest of my podcast, and I hope to have her back at some point soon. So listen to them talk Speed. Mm-hmm. And next up for Watching in the 80s is episode number 31. And Jamie returns as we explore maybe one of the less popular one of the movies of the Halloween franchise, but still one that Jamie and I appreciate, and we decided we're going to talk about it. And that is Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. You a fan of that one, Jer?
Happy, happy Halloween.
Yeah, there we go. There we go. Silver Shamrock. Okay. Very good. Very good movie. A standalone movie, I would say. People just, I guess, well, we'll talk about it at the time, but I think a lot of people just don't like it because it has nothing to do with Michael Myers per se, save maybe one minor reference, I think. Haven't done my research yet, but if I remember correctly, I think there is some reference to one of the earlier films. But yeah, we're going to visit that because it's going to be fun. It's one that I remember from my childhood. Just kind of those on Saturday afternoon, creepy Halloween time movies. And it's like, what the heck is this? Kind of like it. I don't know. We'll see. But it's one of those ones that sticks with you. Anything else you got to say, Jer?
Yeah, just going back to the It franchise.
Oh, yeah, real quick. Sure.
Yeah, between the 1990 miniseries and the 2017 theatrical release, mm-hmm. that's actually the 27-year gap in the It story.
Oh, done intentionally, of course.
I'm assuming so, but even if it was unintentional, I really like the coincidence. And it kind of gives, for those of us that can remember that span of time very well, like I could, because I was in college in 1990. Mm-hmm. And I remember it's like thinking back to where I was in 1990 and where I am now, and working in my job now, and having that gap of years, being like 12 and then nearly 40. So like the characters in the film, that's like, it offers a different perspective. Plus, I read the book when it was released when I was in high school.
Nice.
And that's, yeah. And again, that's not a thin book either. That thing easily, like, I want to say about 800 or so pages. So.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Yeah, I never read it. I should probably pick it up and read it one of these times, 'cause like I said, I did like the original one. And I would probably like the newer one too. As long as it's not too, in your face gross. There's only so much of that I could tolerate. Oh, plus it has a creepy clown. Hello. All right. Well, hey, thanks for joining me for this. This was a lot of fun. I love revisiting Poltergeist. It's a great time of year for it. Love these October movies. And we're gonna have you back real soon doing something, okay?
All right, sounds good.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to Watched in the 80s, and hope you enjoyed us covering Poltergeist. I'm Damien.
And I'm Jerry.
And until next time, remember, you watched it in the 80s, and you can watch it now.
Da-da-da.